January the 21st, 1963 at Fairbanks, Alaska, and the time now is 1:15 p.m. in the afternoon. And I have here in the house with me Bill Burke, a very old-time pioneer, and Frank Young. And they're going to reminisce a little bit about early day history and the story about the black bear. And this is Harry Hughes recording for Igloo 4.
Right.
Bill, what year did you come to Alaska?
1907.
And where did you arrive at?
St. Michael.
And was you coming in as a prospector, or how did you, who was you associated with?
I was in the Army. I was a soldier.
What was it, the infantry?
The infantry, the 10th Infantry.
10th Infantry.
We came from Honolulu. Across, straight across the valley and then around the coast.
In 1907. And what was the name of the old military post at St. Michael then?
It was named St. Michael then.
Yeah, but I say, what was the name of the old post?
Well, they called it Fort St. Michael, but the original old post in St. Michael was Fort Get There.
Fort Get There.
That was the first Army post was ever in St. Michael.
Well, how did it come by that name, Bill?
Well, that I couldn't tell you. I never heard. I suppose that they were just a signal corps, a bunch of engineers had been sent there, and they just named it that for to get there or die, you know, the way they...
Yeah.
I imagine that's the way it was named. I don't know. But that was really the name of St. Michael when the first was a military post.
That was the 10th Infantry.
The 10th Infantry, when I got there, but they'd been outfits there before me.
Oh.
The 3rd Infantry had been there, and the 7th, but I didn't come there until... My outfit came there in 6, but this battalion was in Honolulu, the one I was in, and they didn't send us till the next year.
Well, Bill, how long did you stay there?
Well, I was in the Army then till 10. In June 1910, I bought out, and I went to work for the Army as a civilian.
Well, there was some years in there that you was connected with the Signal Corps, wasn't you?
Oh, no, that was years after. See, I quit the Army in 1910. I bought out. And then I was out and carried mail and worked for the Army for 8 years till the First World War came on. Then I was in the draft age, and I went back in the Army during the First World War. And then I wound up in the Signal Corps. And I was in that 4 years, that's a little over.
Yeah, well, Bill, you're an old-time resident of Nenana.
Yes, I've been in Nenana since 1929. I lived right in town.
And you used to carry mail in those days?
Yes.
In other words, you'd have mail contract.
Yes, I carried mail out of Nenana 8 years.
Well, where was you carrying it from? From Nenana to where?
Flat,
Alaska. And how often did you have to make a trip with that mail?
Once a week.
Once a week?
Mm-hmm.
One way?
One way.
Yeah.
We were 5 teams.
Oh?
Oh.
Well, can you name some other old-time mail carriers that was carrying mail about that time on that trail?
Well, Fred Milligan was carrying mail there for me, and Lars Nelson, and Fred Clark, Jack Lamont, and A.C. Olin. Taylor used to be here. He carried mail there for a while. Charlie Armour. Fred Lemon, we had a native, Peter Demoski, from Nulato. He carried mail with me 7 or 8 years on the Yukon, and he carried mail 3 years over here. And there was an old-timer named Charlie Koenig in McGrath, and Charlie O'Halloran, and a halfway named Pete Snow. There were other fellows made should trip maybe be on for a month or
so.
Ice.
Well, Bill, what I was going to say was, I guess you got out into some pretty severe weather. That is, the temperature's way down sometimes.
Well,
you travel, when was the coldest you can recall traveling on that trail?
The coldest I ever traveled on this trail was 62.
And how long was you out in it?
Oh, I made 40 miles.
40 miles.
Maybe 10 hours.
10 hours. Well, I was going to say, now about your dogs going through an ordeal like that. Did they come out of that okay in the spring? They didn't die from frost?
No.
Decreasing their lungs?
Well, a dog that bothers his lungs, he's pulling and breathing, he's got short winds, you know. They'll really thoughts come out of his mouth. And you will notice that. There'd be blood on his hair, you know, where the eye always should turn him loose. And they'll them run behind. They're pulling and breathing so hard, you know, that they'll start to bleed.
Yeah.
Well, then you better turn him loose or you'll kill him. And I used to have one or two in the team maybe that do that. Some dogs work lots harder than others.
Yeah.
And they can't pull that way when it's 60 below.
No. Well, now, Bill, we'd like to discuss with you the notorious Black Bear case. That was a post office robbery that happened on that trail from Nenana to Flat in the vicinity of whose roadhouse was it now?
Schermeyer's.
Schermeyer's Roadhouse. And just exactly where was that located?
It was 19 miles this side of Iditarod. On the Iditarod River.
Well, Bill, now could you start us off and tell us who was driving that mail and how come the mail was delayed and how it got to where it was robbed and about Nellie Beattie and Bates and a few more characters that was mixed up in this mail post office robbery?
Well, that mail was a payroll shipment going to Scotland to a man named Aiken, Tom Aiken, to pay off his dredge crew. And the mail carriers lost it. They took the long trail and lost it out in the woods and then come back for grub and dog feed.
Now, just let me interrupt you, Bill. How come that those fellas got lost on that trail? Wasn't that a well-known, well-beaten trail marked, or?
No.
It wasn't?
No.
Well,
neither one of them. There were two trails leaving Lake Majumna, and they took the wrong one. They took the right-hand trail that went down the Country Quim, the North Fork, and the left-hand trail went through to Salida, through that way. And they left on the wrong side of the lake. They didn't know.
Well, what I was going to say was they went as far as they could and then they dropped the mail off. Was that it?
They went as far as they could go. They were out of grub and dog feed and they figured to get back to Lake Majumna.
And they took the mail off the sled and cached the mail sacks someplace?
Yeah.
Under a tree or where did they put it?
Yeah, just dumped it out there on the trail and come back. So they were going to get more grub or dog feed and then go back. And when they got back, it snowed, and they couldn't find it.
They couldn't find it, but
it was there for 2 months before it was found.
Well, wasn't there some other old prospector or a trapper that was in that part of the country that had come across those mail sacks?
Yes.
What was his name?
Gaston St. Clair.
Yeah, Gaston St. Clair. Well, Gaston St. Clair, I know he wrote some very fine verse about the old-timer of this country, and I've always considered the one poem that he wrote called Old Dog a Masterpiece. That's my way of looking at that poem that he wrote.
Uh-huh.
Well, now, to get back to the mail robbery, will you go ahead now, Bill, and continue from there?
It was that ice trail. When they got the mail back to Lake Majumna, they sent it on in on the mail
they found it again, and...
And then they started into McGrath. Well, the postmistress there couldn't unlock the lock. She had no key for one of those brass locks, a registered lock. She had to send it on to Platt, and they unlocked it in there and put an ordinary lock on. And so when they brought it back, the first night out of Iditarod, they left the mail outdoors and it was stolen.
Now, they left the mail outdoors at this, that roadhouse. Who was running it? What was his name?
Schermeyer.
And was Nellie Bates and Nellie...
And Duffy, the mail carrier. She was traveling with him. She was going out over the trail.
Oh, I see.
She was going... a passenger.
Oh, I see.
On the mail.
Uh-huh. And that night, when the mail was left out, the mail was robbed that night.
The mail was robbed that night.
Well, now, have you got any details on that, just how that took place or what did happen?
Well, no. It came out at the trial here that this Nellie had taken the mail into this roadhouse and gave it to this roadhouse man, Schermeyer. And then he went on with the mail, and he went to the post office at Ophir and didn't report the mail in that sack missing.
Well, now, Bill, wasn't there a little coincidence that happened there where old Schermeyer took the mail sacks that night that he robbed the mail and took them up the trail and laid them on, after getting the money out of them, and laid them on the trail so that...
somebody would pick them up.
So somebody would pick them up.
And this fellow drove by him. He started early in the morning and didn't see him.
Well, now, what was his name?
Chester Brink.
Chester Brink. Was he carrying mail?
No, not then.
No.
He had carried mail.
Well, he passed him by as he was... It was early in the morning, and he didn't see him, and then in the meantime, the old-timer that was in on this mail robbery, he went and retrieved the mail sacks.
He went out and got them and brought them back and burned them in the stove.
Yeah.
According to his own evidence, and then he took the locks and rivets and all the hardware and took it out about a mile and a half on the trail towards Flat. And dumped them, threw them out against a couple of birch trees. He remembered right where he threw them because a couple of years afterwards he led the post office inspectors out there and got them.
Yeah, well now, Bill, how much currency, this was currency in this,
yes, it was currency.
Approximately, how many $1,000 was mixed?
$30,000. $30,000 was in that shipment.
Okay.
They were in.
And
there were no bills in it bigger than a 20. There was ones, $1,000 ones, if I remember right, and the rest was 5 and 10.
Well, when as the evidence showed later on, they whacked this money up. Is that correct?
Yes.
Well, now tell the part where the old man goes with his part.
Well, according to the way it came out, this Black Bear, Nellie Beatty, she told him that Duffy would get blamed for that. He was the mail carrier, and that he had nothing to do with it and didn't know nothing about it, that she stole it, and that they'd ought to give him an equal amount. And so he gave $5,000, and she gave $5,000 out of the 30, you see, so they'd all get $10,000 apiece. Well, he gave his part to the Black Bear, and she was delivered to Duffy. And then Duffy he wasn't supposed to know anything about this, but Schermeyer only got $10,000 out of it.
Well, then, when they split the pot, the following spring, or did Nellie the Black Bear come on to Fairbanks with Bates at that time?
No, she stayed She didn't come in for, she mined, I think. And it was the next year that she, that next winter she went outside.
Well, how about the old man now with his part of the loot?
Well, he stayed over there a year or so. We worked for a fellow named Harry Duane on the restaurant. He took care of his garden and stuff there for the restaurant. And he worked the next year anyway, and maybe that fall he got sick and started outside.
Well, now, Bill, do you know how he carried that money, or as the evidence showed, how he got out to the States with it?
He had it in the flashlight, and he had a big, long flashlight, and he had a wire soldered on from one to the other, and he had the money wrapped around that, and he could turn that flashlight on and it worked. And then he had some that canned tobacco, and he steamed the seals off of it.
Prince Albert.
Prince Jung.
Yeah, Prince.
Band, and he poured the tobacco out and crammed that full of money, and then put a little back on top, and he had his package back and stuck the stamps back on, and after writing the suitcase, the marshal and the mail clerk at Nenana packed it from the hotel down to the train, put it on for him.
That's pretty good.
Hagen and the old mail clerk named Wetzler, old Wetzler.
Well, now, Bill, they all got to the States. Old Schermeyer and Nelly, and Black Bear, and Bates, they got out with the money, didn't they?
Oh, the Bear, never, she never went out.
Oh, she never went out.
The Bear kept the money, and they said they had the serial numbers for this money. Well, she marked some $20 bills and put them in circulation, you know. And they come to Fairbanks and back to the bank, back to over there. And she got a hold of them and she says, the hell with their serial numbers, they don't know nothing. And she paid off her crew, mining crew in the flat with that money.
Well, now
paid it all right out. Right?
The post office inspectors, detectives, they had been working a couple of years on this case, as I understood it at the time. And finally, the old man, when he was about ready to die out there, he turned state's evidence, didn't he?
Yeah.
Well, can you tell us a little about that, Bill?
Well, he went out there to Schermeyer. They never suspicioned him at all. I knew the mail inspector, and I talked to lots of them that was in here. I knew them all then. They didn't suspicion Schermeyer at all. They never even questioned him. And he went outside and he got sporting around playing the horse races somewhere down California. And then the talk was they put a post office detective on him. And so they did, two or three of them, I guess. And they didn't give him time to sleep or nothing, you know. They kept him running around there and doping him. And he finally got so run down that he was going to die, he claimed. And then he sent for the inspector in Seattle that he knew Pinkham and told him that there was a fellow up here blamed for that mail robbery that had nothing to do with it. And that he wanted to confess and tell him how it was, and he did. And they brought him right out of it and brought him back up here, then arrested the Bear. Lynn Smith arrested him.
Well, he turned state's evidence on the Black Bear, Nellie Bates, and Bates together, didn't he?
Not Bates.
Just
Duffy.
The Bear.
Duffy.
Oh, Duffy, yeah.
Yeah, she quit with Bates years before that.
Oh, I see, yeah. It was the Black Bear, Nellie, and Duffy.
Duffy.
And they were arrested here.
And they were arrested in Iditarod.
In Iditarod and brought to trial here in Fairbanks.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
2 or 3 years afterwards.
Yeah, 2 or 3 years afterwards. Well, I was going to ask you, now, They had the smartest criminal lawyer that I think, to my estimation, I was a young man in them days, but he was a brilliant man,
yeah.
Tom Markham.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I heard part of that trial here, and, well, anyway, the Black Bear and Duffy were acquitted.
Yes.
Would you know anything about it, how that acquittal took place, if they couldn't convict him, or?
Well, I don't know. I heard that the Shermire was so bitter, you know, and swore the stuff that they caught him lying a time or two, I guess. He was awful sore out after he found out the way the Bear gypped him by the 5,000. Oh, he went all out, you know. And the jury decided that he was just out for revenge more than anything else, and he swears anything, whether it was the truth or whether it wasn't. And then he was kind of aged, and they thought he was a little dippy anyway. A man 72 years old, getting into a deal like that with a woman you know don't sound right either.
Yeah, well, they were acquitted, it was quite a notorious case all over Alaska and I guess part of the United States, especially around Seattle at the time. Well, Bill, what I was going to say was all of those characters are now gone to the happy hunting grounds, is that right? They're all dead.
One thing that looked awful funny to me about that, now that mail carrier Duffy, he lost the mail. It was stole out of his sled. And he never was on the witness stand at no time during the trial. How in the hell would they?
That's one of the. Well, makes me laugh.
Pull off a trial without finding out from that mail carrier how he lost it.
Well, I don't know. That's one of the ways that these criminal lawyers have of. Proceeding with those kind of trials. Maybe he thought it best for his clients not to put this man on the stand.
But he wasn't never on the stand. The government subpoenaed him, brought him in here 1 year. The next year, it was hung jury the first time, so they tried it again.
Yeah.
And the next time they didn't subpoena him, but he come anyway. he brought the Bear in both times.
Yeah.
For his own
I was just wondering now to get to the climax of the Black Bear case, as it was known in the early days here in Fairbanks. Nellie was a lady of the evening, wasn't she, Bill?
Oh, yes.
Here in Fairbanks, too, I remember her here.
All over.
Yeah. Well, she was a very nice-looking woman. And
she was an awful nice woman.
Yeah.
Ladylike in every way. Well liked.
Well, did she, in her days, I've been told, like the Oregon mayor, she grubstaked a few boys to go off in the hills prospecting?
And I bet she spent $2,000 every spring buying ice pool tickets for old timers.
For old timers?
Yeah.
Just giving them the tickets
just
for free.
Just tell them to go ahead and buy them. She'd buy tickets for them herself.
Yeah.
Well, she couldn't see, you know.
Well, that's good. Well, Bill, have you got anything further you'd like to say about this Black Bear case? Or I guess we've told the whole story as far as you can recall.
the laugh at the witnesses coming in, you know. I was carrying mail on. And they'd come in and they'd make every place there was a cabin, they'd stay all night, you know.
Yeah.
And they'd buy fish and.
No, I didn't. The longer they stayed, the more money they made.
Well, whatever it cost them to come in, you know.
Yeah.
Why they would allow them the same to go back.
Yeah.
And all it take them 20 days to come in, you know, $12, $15, $20, $30 a day. Wanted to hire a dog team to buy. They buy enough dog feed, cash feed to go home on. One of them went from here in 5 days going back. And one guy, they put in bills for everything, every nickel. And one fella put in a bill for his laundry. Great figure. And he told him that was about it. But he was the only one that ever. But they paid him for his laundry while he was here. A fellow named Jack Whitaker. He was from Sher Myers. He had a cabin right alongside the roadhouse. God, I laughed at.
Yeah, well, Bill, we want to thank you very much for coming up here and giving us this story. And
but that's that's putting it right, too. I knew all of them. That Virginia Howard, she was there that night. She was a sporting woman from Ophir. She was at the roadhouse that night. And
the night of the robbery?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And
and the name of that roadhouse where the mail robbery took place was
Shermeyer's.
Shermeyer's Roadhouse. It was 19 miles from Flat.
By a trail.
On the Iditarod Trail.
On the Iditarod River, too.
Yeah.
Right on the river.
Uh-huh.
And it was 50 miles from the river.
Well, Bill, here, there's a little part of this thing we forgot. Now, I was going to ask you, this old fellow Shermeyer, he was convicted, wasn't he?
Yes.
Okay, and according to his age and him turning state's evidence, they give him a kind of a mild sentence, is that right?
Yeah, they let him off with a year.
1 year. And what become of the deal? Did he serve the year, do you know?
Well, no, they farmed him out to the railroad, the Curry Hotel. I guess the railroad was running at that time. He was gardener out there in Florida.
They farmed him out to the Curry
Hotel
on the Alaska Railroad.
Yeah, that's where he spent the year.
Spent the year there. And what was he doing?
Taking care of the flower gardens and the garden there.
So that's the way he ended up.
That's the way he wound up. I seen him there myself in the 29.
Yeah, well, Bill, I want to thank you very much on behalf of the pioneers of Alaska and Harry Hughes. And
now, before you terminate this, I'd like to ask Bill a few questions. Bill, where were you born?
Illinois. Clinton, Illinois.
Clinton, Illinois. And what year was that?
1887.
1887. And your early life there, what was your father and mother's name? Can you remember those?
Well, my father's name was James. My mother's name was Joanne.
Joanne was your mother's name. Now, did you have any brothers or sisters?
I had six half-sisters and one half-brother, and I had one full sister.
Can you give the names of those on the tape here?
Well, I had a half-brother named James Burke, I suppose he did, and my half-sisters, they were all married. I could give their married names.
Yeah, that would help.
Well, one of them was married to a man named Newt Samuels in Clinton, Illinois. Another was married to Lawrence Murphy, and there was one married to Richard Ball, and one to Clive McDonald, one to Anson Bowers, one to Alan Reynolds. And one to a fellow named Ed Corrigan. She was in Omaha, Nebraska.
Now, when you were in Alaska, you got married. What year did you get married, and what was your wife's name?
Well, I got married first time in 1912 or 13. It probably was the first part of 1913 that I got married. First, at Loudon.
Her name was Loudon?
No, her name was Anna Brush.
Anna Brush.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we split up, and then in 23, I married Rosie.
Rosie.
The one I got now, Rosie Big Joe.
Big Doe was her name?
Rosie Big Joe.
Big Joe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you had how many children?
We've got six.
Can you give those names on the tape?
Yes. The oldest boy is Bill, and the oldest girl is Rosie. Then I got another girl, Marie, and a boy named Johnny, and a boy named Joe, and a girl named Altona.
Altona.
She's the youngest.
Any of them married?
Four
of them's married.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. You understand this background information, if this story's ever written up by the pioneers, that you have a lot of offspring that would like to know where their granddaddy was or their great-granddaddy. And that's the idea, get as much information on the tape as we can.
Mm-hmm.
That's all right, Bill.
And, my two youngest kids is not married. One boy and one girl. I got the boy, got six kids.
You got six grandchildren by one boy?
Yeah.
How many grandchildren altogether?
14.
14 grandchildren?
Huh.
No great grandchildren yet?
Huh?
No great grandchildren yet?
No.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bill, I want to say the same as Frank, to thank you for the information, and I know that sometime in later years, some of your friends will hear about you, and they'll be glad to hear the history of it. Now I'll terminate this, and the time right now is 1:50 p.m. in the afternoon of January the 21st, 1963, at Fairbanks, Alaska.
I see.
Now, Frank's going to ask for a little more background history of the party known as the Black Bear, and Bill's going to try to give him an explanation of it.
There's one little question that I've had many people ask these days. Now that we speak of the Black Bear case, I'm going to ask my old friend Bill here. Bill, how did Nellie come by the name of the Black Bear?
Well, I've heard that she was hair all over, just like a black bear.
You mean the most of her body was covered with black hair?
Most of her body
black
was
hair.
Covered with black hair, that's what they claim.
Yeah, well, that's the way she got the name.
That's the way I understand it.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, that's... Thank you, Bill. And
you were going to ask him about the telegraph. You go drift into that.
The telegraph?
Telegraph, when he went worked in the telegraph.
Oh, what year was it? What year was it you was out with the Signal Corps?
From 19 till 22.
19
to 22.
From 1919 to 1922. Hmm. Well, where was you located then?
Well, my station was town hall, but I was all over the line, you know, on construction and...
Yeah. Was you ever on that old Eagle Trail, Bill?
No. No, I never was on that.
Now, that trail, let me ask you, where did that start at?
Well, I don't know. The first I seen of it was around Salinas.
Yeah, but I think it started over in Valdez, didn't it?
Well, oh yeah, originally it started out of Valdez.
Yeah.
And come up to Salinas, and through to Tamnall Crossing that way.
Mantasta?
Somewhere around Tamnall Crossing.
Yeah, they crossed there. And that was Billy Mitchell's expedition, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know. Mitchell went all the way to St. Michael.
Yeah, but that was his. He
I suppose he was on that too. I don't know.
He blazed that trail in there. Then they crossed there and went into Mansfield's Lake and Mosquito Fork and down the 40 mile.
Yeah, I've seen.
And they finally hit Eagle, or am I a little mixed up there now?
No, when they went across there, was Bob Swarthout. He went over in there while I was a tope for the road commission, and he told me there's parts of that line standing over there in the wire just as good as they was put there, like, yeah, today.
Yeah, that was in 96.
I was put there, yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
But this line down the river was getting around 1900 before it got through to St. Michael.
Yeah, where was that going to? Where did it come from? Where was it going?
It come from Valdez through to Fairbanks and down the Tannenhall to Tannenhall and down the Yukon to Coltag, across the Portage to Unalakleet, and around the coast to St. Michael. Mm-hmm. And they put a cable from Unalakleet to Nome.
What year was that, Bill?
In 1900.
1900.
Harry Lucky was down there then.
Yeah.
And But rabbits keep eating the bark off of this cable, and reindeer was waking it, and so then they put a ground cable in. Well, the ice would take it out. See, it's so shallow on the beach, so the ice would kill it,
mm-hmm.
keep tearing that out. So they put a wireless station in there, from Nome to, I'm going to say, Michael. You had a landline from Valdez to St. Michael, then wireless to Nome. And that wireless was up and working when I was there.
Mm-hmm. Well, what year was it that they put the wireless in? Can you recall that?
Not exactly, but I think it was around 1904. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was 1904. Mm-hmm. Fred Milligan's brother built that.
Is that right?
He was the first man in there. He didn't go by the name of Milligan. He enlisted in the army under the name of Wilson.
Oh?
He was a Cracker Jack radio man, that fella.
Hmm.
He had a lot more brains than Milligan.
Well, Bill,
he's the only man in the history of the army that ever made master sergeant, electrician, in his first enlistment.
Is that right?
At the time I was in.
Well, Bill, in those days, what was the
you want cream and sugar?
The wages?
Cream and sugar.
That
sugar, yeah.
The plain GI got in those days, say the Signal Corps or the infantry.
Well, you got 12 6-bits a month.
12 6-bits. Was that for?
$13.
Yeah.
But they took out 2 bits a month for the old soldiers at home. So you got 12 6-bits.
12 6-bits. Yeah. Now you're just talking about the plain GI.
Yeah.
How about the sergeants and?
Well, they got $5 a month more.
Five a month more.
And corporal got 3. And then you got $10.85 up here for if you're out on the line for extra duty, and you got 20%. Foreign duty, foreign service. And I was an expert rifleman. You got $5 a month for that.
Expert rifleman?
Yeah.
Sharpshooter.
Uh-huh.
And you got 20% on that, so I got $6 for expert rifleman and 15. Well, they raised it the last time I was in. What was it up here during the war? $30, I think. $30 during the war, and 20% on that. And then they give you so much for laundry and and different allowances. I was drawing a little over $60 a month.
Well, that salary wouldn't go very far today, would it, Bill?
No.
No, the way prices are and everything. Yeah, well, Bill.
When I first joined the Army in St. Louis, They chased up a big building way up at Jefferson Bank, way up on top of the hill up there to pay off. And they paid cash. There was a little Jew down the post, he was taking pictures. And he had a cavalry outfit and a big saber, you know. These recruits all go to get their pictures taken. He'd slap his blouse on them and put them up there, take a picture, and they'd all mail them home. So when you went, you get paid. You paid your canteen bill and your barber, and they was all, so you walked out, you paid on the way out. So. And this Jew, the photographer, he was a civilian, he never, they had him all out on the out end, you know. Well, some of these recruits should be in the army, oh, they don't have a week's pay coming to see him. They wouldn't have enough. They'd go past this Jew and he'd, oh, he'd these officers would be laughing like hell, you know.
Never had enough left to pay him.
Probably. The recruit would be gone, he'd be shipped out someplace before another payday, you know. You wouldn't get none.
Well, Bill, thank you very much for all your talk. It's been very interesting.
God, I used to...
Let him talk to you once. Go ahead. Go ahead.
That's I used to laugh at that Christian Jew.
Yeah. Well, Harry, I guess that's about the end.
We had one tailor, a Jew down at Tannenhof, and he'd make your bed and shine your shoes and do all your work, you know, for $2 a month, I think. So he finally opened up the tailor shop, and there was a little lieutenant, a little short fella named Mason. That Mason Creek down there below was named after him. He was a grub tailor. So, him and a big, tall lieutenant named Ridgway, he would have the officer's ball. They called the officer hop or some military hop. So this Mason, he wanted to get his pants pressed and clean. And this lieutenant, he bought a new suit out of the quartermaster. They were about 3 inches too long. So they took him over to this guy, cut him off and cleaned him. And so he cut off the short one and pressed the others. And this lieutenant went over here with his pants, Christ didn't come to his knees. So he come over to barracks and he told her, he says, now, I don't want any of you fellas to pay him. He said, if I hear of anybody paying him for this month, he says, I'll court-martial you. He said, he ain't got no business here anyway. And he says, I want to show that Jew something. He was supposed to give 30% of it to the mess, what he made, the motion money, you know. He wouldn't let no... And he had damn near cut his throat, you know. Oh, he was going to desert.
Say, Bill, you knew a character by the name of Frank Elba in those days down there.
Yeah, he was down there.
Well, little Frank used to play the Spanish guitar and the mandocello and mandolin and different instruments. He was a little Spaniard, wasn't he?
Yeah. He was a... he was rafting gas for the army down from Ninan to Galena. And he had a barge down there that was 12 feet wide on the bottom and 24 feet wide on top. And... So he was hauling tar, I think, or something. I think it was tar. And they were 900-pound barrels. And he was up on the top. And he was hauling for freight, you know. So they sent a bunch of us in a drag line up.
And he had nobody down there to help load him. These fellas on top of the soldiers, they just kept pouring it down. He was standing down there, hollering, you know. They finally loaded it. That's a damn much flare, you know. It just tipped over like that. Me and Whitey Hawks come along just as total. It was bars up like this, and he was down in there floating around. Holland blue murder. God, I thought he drowned, you know. I don't know how in the hell he ever got out of there. But they got him out, and they wouldn't give him any more freight. They wrote him off.
They wouldn't give him no more.
Was that during the Second World War when he was hauling the freight?
Yeah.
No. It was 20
years ago or so.
It was in 44.
44.
No.
Well, what else do you know about Frank Alba, though? I heard a little bit about him, and I wondered, you know him, you could tell us something.
Well, I know once he come down to Tanna with a load of hooch, and he cashed it with a fellow, old Mosher, used to know him.
That was in the days of Prohibition,
wasn't it? Yeah. He brought this hooch down there, and he cashed it with Mosher and George Bailey. So he went off somewhere, and they got drunk and gave it all away. So he had them arrested. he wound up doing 6 months himself.
I know Bill knows a lot of good stories because I used to hear him talk about them down there. Once in a while at Lignite, he'd get to talking too.
He had these guys arrested when he owned the whiskey himself.
He bought it down and gave it to him. No. And he swore out a warrant for him for stealing.
Well, Frank Alba come from Spain, and he had a lot of relation over there. You never heard him mention about any of his relations.
No. He was cooking out on the road commission once, and out of Ruby, and Albert Mahoney and I was out to the creeks with a load of freight, and we come back and stop there, and we told him there was a fire right down below, fire coming right up the hill, be there and burn that thing out. He didn't have a half hour to go. There was smoke all over, he couldn't see nothing. He wanted to know where the fire was. We told him it was down by mile, and he got in his goddamn car. No, I don't have any more time. He got his car and beat it to town. When the crew came home for dinner, there was nobody there. Old Pete McMullen was pouring down and he canned him. Got nothing to cook.
Yeah. Well, what do you remember about old Sandy, the camp cook, the old woman that used to cooking the camps around? Old Sandy.
Is that one of the restaurant here?
Yeah.
I never knew her only here in town. I never knew her on the
See, nobody would give her a job here one time in Fairbanks, so she got a Wanigan and pulled it down there where the Griffin Park is, and a bunch of old-timers was going down there and eating with her. She could only seat 4 at a time in front of her counter. You don't remember that?
Oh.
Yeah, I remember when she set that up.
I knew her when she... She had a place where the Wonder Bar is, eh?
Yeah, right in there. Oh. Yeah, it was in there.
Not sure.
Well, Harry, you better play this back to Bill now and see what it sounds like.
See what Bill sounds like? Okay, Bill.
How's that old lady Walker? Is she still around?
Yeah.
God, she must be old.
Yeah,
did you ever dance with her, Bill?
Huh?
You ever dance with her?
No.
She's a good old girl. She likes to dance.
She's a good worker.
Now, I want to add on this tape, this is Harry Hughes recording this tape for Igloo 4, Pioneers of Alaska, at my home at 215 6th Avenue in Fairbanks, Alaska, on this date. Now, I'll read on to the tape a request by a Miss Joanne Wold of 1231 First Avenue, Fairbanks, Alaska, for permission. I'll read the letter. She says, may I have permission, your permission, to use the tape recording you made at the Pioneers of Alaska Igloo 4 meeting during the week of January 20th for use in an article, story, or book about the Black Bear mail robbery. I would certainly appreciate your cooperation in this matter. If I publish any material about the case, I will see to it that you receive a copy. This is addressed to Bill Burke. I enjoyed meeting you the other night and hope we have an opportunity to talk together again sometime in the future. Thank you. Sincerely yours, Joanne Wold. And this letter has an addition onto it written with pen and ink by William Burke, the party interviewed, member of the Pioneers, dated 1-28-63. Permission granted to use tape recording of Black Bear case furnished me. And signed Burke. And it says over. On the next side it says January the 29th, 1963 at Fairbanks, Alaska. I, the undersigned, agreed to let Joanne Wold have the tape, transfer tape, of the Black Bear case if it's okay with Igloo 4, Pioneers of Alaska. And it's signed William Burke. This subject was brought on the floor at the regular meeting of the Igloo 4, Pioneers of Alaska, and the Igloo voted to allow a transfer tape to be made for Miss Joanne Wold at her expense. And I, as recorder for Igloo 4, have made this transfer tape. A little background information. There is a number of libel laws and rights of heirs in regard to any tape stories or transcription of acts or sayings of individuals. And the person receiving or using this tape will have to assume full responsibility as Igloo 4 and Harry Hughes and Frank Young, your moderator and recorder, will not assume any responsibility for its misuse, nor neither will any responsibility fall on Igloo 4, Pioneers of Alaska. And of this date, January the 29th, 1963, I, Harry Hughes, have made this transfer tape and placed this additional information on the end of the tape for the record and to protect the Igloo and all of us concerned. This is Harry Hughes, and this is the end of this instruction.